Hi everyone, Drew Prode here, host of the Broken Brain Podcast. In today's episode, we have Dave Asprey, one of the godfathers of the biohacking movement and the founder of Bulletproof. He's here to teach us how to live to 180 and become superhuman. Stay tuned. It's a fascinating conversation. Welcome to the Broken Brain Podcast, where we dive deep into the topics of neuroplasticity, epigenetics, mindfulness, functional medicine, and mindset. I'm your host, Drew Prode, and each week my team and I bring on a new guest who we think can help you improve your brain health, feel better, and live more. This week's guest is entrepreneur, author, and the godfather, the biohacking movement, and the author of the newly released book, Superhuman, The Bulletproof Plan to Age Backwards and Maybe Even Live Forever. Dave Asprey, welcome back to the podcast. It's an honor to have you here.
Dude, thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Our first interview was great. It the podcast has been going on for about a little over a year.
You're doing great.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. And your podcast was one of the first ones that like skyrocketed in the charts. And beautiful. I can't take any credit for that. That was all you.
Happy to help, man.
and it was great. We were talking about your book, Game Changers, and all the lessons synthesized in there. And I'm excited to do the same for the new book that you have out there. And just the lessons that you learn in life. You're always learning, you're always growing, and you always come back and share that message with the people in your community. So super appreciate that.
It's my pleasure. And one of the things I learned from that last interview, of all the books that I've written, Game Changers has the highest reviews, not number of reviews, but it's like 4.9 out of 5 stars with hundreds of reviews. And it hit the USA Today bestseller list, but not the New York Times list. Yeah. And it was actually harder to write than some of the other books because it was so broad. And it just goes down to the thing, look, if you make something that's really good and you don't do the work right to get people to eat it, to try it, to read it, to consume it, however it is, you've only done half the work.
Yeah.
So I'm working really hard with Superhuman because if we can get people to just believe and understand that when they're old, it doesn't mean tubes and monitors and diapers and not knowing your own name and emptying your bank account to give it to the hospital. That when you're old, it means that you have the energy and the power and the wisdom to give back and to actually do things that matter. It changes everything that we do in the world around us. So there's a mindset element to that, but that's why Superhuman is important. That's why I'm really just ringing the bell for it because it matters.
Yeah, and you have been really sounding... spreading the message in terms of helping people re-question what they think of as aging.
Yeah.
And I want to come back to that idea of like what people normally think, but I want to start off first with the last time you were on the podcast, you shared this ambitious goal, which is also in your book and you've shared with many other people, which is you want to live, your goal is to live to 180.
And at least 180. I don't want to put a cap on it. Yeah. I mean, don't shortchange me, Drew.
Right. And last time you said, I want to live to 180 or die trying, which I always thought was funny. Okay. Real question. How'd you come up with that number? Like realistically, like you could have said 200, 190, you could have said 170, but first of all, you're not joking.
Not in the slightest.
How'd you come up with that exact number? Did you do any kind of formulation?
I did. What I did is I took pi and I divided by Avogadro's number. Okay. No, I didn't.
Our videographer, shout out to Louis for a second. He was listening in. He was like, oh my gosh, this is like the secret.
I totally sucked you in. And then I did the pyramid frequencies. No, the way it works is really straightforward. We know we can do 120 because we've seen it done. Okay. Now, I know because I've run an anti-aging nonprofit group for 20 years because I've learned from people 3 times my age who helped me get rid of the diseases of aging that I had in my 20s. I know that the research is happening. People like Dr. David Sinclair is right now saying after 30 years of working in a laboratory, we actually understand how to turn back the biological clock in cells in a way that has never been done before. So if we can't do 50% better than the current best in the next 134 years of my life, it's because an asteroid hit the planet. Seriously. Drew, just from how glowy your skin is, you have to be a little bit younger than me. How old are you?
I'm 37.
37. All right. I'm 46. So do you remember microfish?
Microfish? I don't.
Okay. So you're right at the cusp. So people as old as me, I'm not that old, right? At least I like to tell myself not. Don't ask my kids. When I would do research, I would go to the library. This is even at the beginning of when I went to university in 1990. And you want to find a scientific reference, you'd find it in the card catalog. Then you go to the microfiche catalog, which is tiny little envelopes of little transparent pieces of plastic where we would photocopy the stuff down onto these tiny little postage stamp side things. And you'd put them inside a little machine that would shine blow a light it through it through a magnifying glass so you could read it.
Okay. I didn't know it was called that, but we used to pick up like old newspapers and
totally
stuff like that.
This is where scientific research happens. So if you wanted to look up stuff about mitochondria, you would spend days of your life pulling little pieces of plastic out. And right now, you and me and everyone listening to the show can go online for free and look at the sum of human knowledge about medical research. Given that, how can we not do 50% better, given the billions and billions of dollars that are going into this, given the past 5,000 years of research on anti-aging, because that's what Taoism is, that's what traditional Chinese medicine is, that's what Ayurveda is. We've been working on this problem for a long time, and we finally have the tools to do it. If we can't do at least 50%, then I'm stupid.
I love it. That's a real answer. All right, we're going to jump around a little bit.
All right.
So I want to jump ahead, and your book has a lot of great themes on it. I want to start off with something that a lot of people think about, not just men, women too, you talk about in your book, which is balding.
Balding is a problem.
You wrote in the book that out of all the things related to like hair and even like sometimes like skin, other things, you didn't say fear, but your biggest concern with aging would be balding.
For me, I look at both of my grandfathers completely bald. All the men on both sides of the family, pretty much completely bald by the time they're 30. So I have just the crappy hair genes. And I'm doing all right. I'd say I have a little bit more forehead than I used to. But I looked in detail at what do we know about this? Not the wives' tales, not the marketing stuff, but actually what causes baldness. Do you know?
Well, I read your book, so it's a little cheating. It's a little bit cheating, but break it down for our audience.
It's not one thing. It's multiple things, just like aging. In Superhuman, I talk about the seven pillars of aging. These are the seven things that make you old. And if you say, I just fixed three of the seven, well, you'll probably do better than you would have before. But that's like saying, you know, I changed three of the tires on my car. Maybe you wanted to change all four when they were bald, because otherwise you're still going to have some problems, but it's better than it was before. So when it comes to your hair, mitochondrial insufficiency. In other words, the hair follicles can't make energy well from food. That is a major thing. So bioenergetics affects your hair. Hormone buildup, something called DHT. It turns out it's important for hair growth to have some, but if you have too much of it, it can cause hair loss. And this is something that we've all heard about. Oh, it's DHT causes hair loss. No, it's just
where,
one
like,
of the things.
Rogaine and a lot of other things are out there just focused on that aspect.
You like Joe Rogaine, the podcast?
Yeah, Joe Rogaine.
No, Rogaine or finasteride is the generic term for it. And that stuff is interesting because in some small percentage of people, it actually shuts down all hormone production. It's essentially like being castrated. So there's more of a downside to that than you might think. And so I'm a little hesitant to take that stuff. It was actually originally meant to be a heart disease medication. And they found that people were growing hair like on their hands in places they normally wouldn't from it. So it became a baldness medication. So I'm not saying you shouldn't do it, just saying it's not without risk. But of the three things that are going to affect your hair, that's one of them. And another big one is heavy metals. And it turns out as we age, like all animals, we bioaccumulate toxic metals. And toxic metals inhibit our cells' ability to do what they're supposed to do. So the odds are pretty high that if you're dealing with balding, that you probably have some of all three of these going on. And you can improve any of the three and your hair can improve, or you can improve all three and you're likely to get much better results. There's other stuff in the book I talk about, like too much sun, bad. No sun at all for hair growth is bad. So you need a little bit of that. You can use light therapy to stimulate hair growth. There's topical things you can do that increase mitochondrial function. And this is going to sound crazy, given that Bulletproof is the company that put collagen on the map. But eating collagen makes your hair grow faster. Like, who would have thought? But it does. It doesn't mean that you're necessarily going to rescue an old hair follicle. I even, in the book, talk about, hey, what happens if you inject stem cells into your hair? Should you do ozone in your hair? Should you do hyperbaric oxygen? Like, what's likely to work? But the lens of everything in Superhuman is through return on investment. Because Drew, you and me and anyone listening could spend 24 hours a day doing the craziest anti-aging things and have no time left for life. And you'd still probably die eventually anyway. So how do you pick the ones that are going to give you the results you want in the least possible amount of time, energy, and dollars? And I've gone through and I've done the really expensive, crazy stuff in part to write the book. And also in part because when it really works dramatically, if it costs $50,000 to do something now, well, A, because I'm writing a book about it, I probably got it for a lot less than that. And B, it'll cost $5,000 in 10 years. It'll cost $500 in 15 years. And it'll cost $50 in 20 years, just like cell phones did. So anti-aging technologies are just coming online. And part of the reason I wrote Superhuman is our mindset of age is you are powerful, you are wise, you move under your own power, you look pretty darn good, you have an active, fun sex life, you have a social life, and you have the energy to do all this stuff and you like it. And if that's where you're going, you change the decisions you make right now. And maybe you'll pass on the French fries because you know there's just better stuff to do and you don't want to take these thousands of micro hits that we take every day with small choices. You make better choices. You eat food you love that makes you feel good and makes you age less quickly. And as you do that, these amazing technologies are coming online and they're getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper.
That's the possibility. That's showing what the possibility is moving forward. We can't fully talk about the possibility without addressing the hidden beliefs that people have about aging. In fact, You kind of started off the podcast by talking about this like decrepit idea that people have of aging. You were interviewing Maria Shriver, right. Mutual friend.
I love Maria.
And you were interviewing her on your podcast and she was saying, Dave, I know you want to live to 180 and you can have that goal. Like I don't want to live that long. And that kind of led to like a discussion and a conversation that you talk about in the book of, well, what are your beliefs about that? Part of why you wrote this book is about, okay, what's possible? Can we live longer? But what does also mean to live better? So where did these beliefs come from? And sometimes it's like, let's state the obvious, like what are the beliefs that people do have about what is possible when it comes to aging right now?
If you believe that life is meaningless, you have no purpose in life, you should probably check out now. Like seriously, why are you here? And if you don't know the answer to that, that's your number one thing to figure out. And when you have something that's worth living for that gets you up in the morning, every morning, then you start saying, you know what? I think I like this and I want to do it. So if you're dealing with depression or you're just searching for a reason to be here, it's okay. But you deal with that first. And when you get that solved, you realize that life is precious and that wisdom is precious too. And if you're young, one of the best things you could possibly do is find someone two or three times your age and become friends with them. And I'm fortunate that I had most of the diseases of aging before I was 30. I had prediabetes, at high risk of stroke and heart attack, cognitive dysfunction, arthritis, stretch marks, all kinds of bad stuff that no one in their 20s should have. And it was a combination of the things that I've written about in the book, toxic molds, heavy metals, and other just genetic things, right? If I could hack those things, then most people listening didn't start out with, you know, chronic fatigue syndrome and all the other crap that I've reversed. But one of the reasons I was able to do this is a friend said, Dave, you should go hang out with this anti-aging group in the Bay Area. I'm like, I'm not even 30. Why? And they said, just go. These are your people. So I'm already taking smart drugs. I'm trying to fix myself. And I sit down and there's a guy who's 88 years old. His name is Mike. And we stayed out talking till 11:30 at night. And he's just really excited about, there's this new stuff, all these things we learned about coconut oil. And you know, we're going to change the world. And how do we share this? I'm like, holy crap, this guy has more energy than me. And he's three times my age. And when his wife passed away, he started dating a 36-year-old who he was actually in love with. It was unusual, but he had the energy of a 35-year-old because he managed his biology that way. And I saw it was possible. I learned from these people. I learned from their wisdom and their mindset. I'm like, if they can do it with the lives that they've led without the knowledge or the tools that you and I have available just by virtue of our age, man, there's a lot more capacity that we have as humans. But you have to have the mindset first that says, the picture of aging that I have of being old and decrepit is wrong. I reject that outright. And what that'll do is probably best highlighted by a guy named John Medina who came on Bulletproof Radio. He's a cognitive scientist and I believe psychologist from UW. And he talked about a study where they took older people in their 70s, 80s, 90s. And they put them in a hotel that had been decorated like the 1950s, as in the TVs from the 50s, TV shows from the 50s, food from the 50s, all the stuff from antique shops. And they measurably got younger from spending a weekend in that environment. So the mind has so much control over our aging that that's a part of this. But your job, everyone's job here is just say, you know what, when I'm old, I'm going to be giving back. I'm going to be full of energy. I'm going to be under my own power. That is what aging always looked like. The normal way we would age in a tribe was you were functional, you're old. Yeah, you might have a sore back or something like that, but you were a member of the tribe and you were revered and respected for your wisdom. And then one day you died and it came quickly because you were healthy until you died.
You died in your sleep. You know, my dad, yeah. I talk to him often and he's like, I can trace back like 13 generations in our family. And I know a lot of people can trace back even more than that. And I would ask him as a kid, like, oh, what happened to like this person and that person? There was this trend where it was like, yeah, you know, they were cleaning and walking around and doing stuff. And then, you know, they were living their life and they were in their 80s and 90s and other stuff. And then one time, you know, great grandmother went to bed and then she didn't wake up.
Yeah.
She was functional. No chronic diseases.
Yes.
That were there. And really, I guess what Maria Shriver, you know, who's awesome, was saying is that this vision that I have of what it looks like to be 80 or 90 in that moment in that conversation is that I'm in a nursing home. Mm. I am at high risk of a hip fracture. I am at high risk of getting pneumonia or cancer, one of these other things, and I don't have mobility. And the biggest fear is people feeling like their brain is going to break.
Yeah. That's why I love this broken brain, because of all the fears, okay, it is ignoble to say I'm wearing Depends right now, but at least you're not locked in a room the way they used to do 50 years ago, because, oh, if you're incontinent, you know, you're no longer able to be in society. So we've at least fixed that part. But it's another thing to say, I don't recognize my children. I put my car keys in the fridge, because there's a very visceral sense of just loss of you, and you can feel it going away. And I know this viscerally because in my mid-20s, I had such bad cognitive function. Things were going wrong. Like, I went to the doctor. I'm like, I feel like I've been poisoned. Like, I can't remember stuff in meetings at all. I have no recollection of being there, but I know I was there. And I'd go to the store and I have no idea why I went to the store. And I'd open the fridge. I don't know why I'm doing this. And I'd sit there and I would say, I was going to say something. There's a word for that. And I would just struggle for the word. I'm a New York Times bestselling author. I've had almost 700 episodes of Bulletproof Radio. I don't forget a word. And if it happens, I can tell you exactly what I did the day before that caused a little bit of brain inflammation that caused it. And when I was in my 20s, I would lose words dozens of times a day. The same thing that happens to a lot of people in their 60s. And it is scarier than hell. And it's unnecessary. And it turns out I fixed my broken brain. And yes, you reduce toxins. Yes, you fix mitochondrial function. And you do the other things that keep you young. And, but that fear of saying, man, I think I'm going to buy disability insurance because I don't know if I'm going to be able to take care of myself next year. And it's hard to put words behind the fear that's there. And that is why people are afraid of aging, because you have that picture of I'm losing myself. And it's not how it's supposed to be. And if that happens, we can reverse it. I mean, you have a whole docuseries about fixing broken brains. They can be fixed. The fact that I can do what I do, given where I was, is testimony to what the work you're doing.
Bill Gates, I think, still the richest man in the world. I know him and Warren Buffett go back and forth.
Yeah, and Jeff Bezos, they're arm wrestling every day.
Yeah, they're
over
arm wrestling. Yeah. He has a new sort of docuseries out on Netflix with the director of The Inconvenient Truth. And I watched the first episode. It talks about his philanthropic work and the legacy and how did Bill Gates become who he is. And halfway through the first episode, the director interviewed him and was asking him questions and said, what's your biggest fear? And his biggest fear was that his brain would stop breaking. And really, in a way, he was saying Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
And that is the biggest fear that the richest man in the world has. And yet, going back to your original comment, we are now, for the first time in history, at a much more rapid level through the internet and all the attention that's on the space. We are starting to spread the message of actually understanding what's possible in helping us avoid, prevent, or reverse that.
There is so much good science about it. And what drives me nuts is that whether it comes to what we eat, what we do in a typical doctor's office, it is 20 or 30 years behind cutting edge research. And a large part of my nonprofit anti-aging work has just been finding the experts and then finding the experts who are credible and are usually right. And what's frustrating for academics, they look at something and they say, you know what? I think this is probably true. And they might even, if they're adventurous, try it on themselves and get great benefits. But if they publish something that says it's true and they don't put, but more research is needed at the end, and then someone else publishes something, even something that is flawed that says the opposite, they lose their academic stripes. They lose respect. So we have this fear mongering amongst people saying, well, we just noticed this huge thing that no one ever saw before. But before we do anything about it, more research is needed. And here's the deal. You and me and everyone listening to this, we're on the path towards dying. And we can wait until more research is completed, or we can do the things that are most likely to be beneficial right now and course correct as we go.
Most likely to be beneficial and show and are like the most straightforward to do and have demonstrated to be the lowest possibility of side effects or no side effects.
And in fact, some of them, the side effects are, well, you feel better. Like there are some exceptionally low side effects. And you could say, well, side effects, look, you can have a salad, you can have a piece of grass-fed steak, or you can have deep-fried cheese sticks, right? What are the side effects of that? And why do you think it's okay to eat the deep-fried cheese sticks? It actually isn't. If you're worried about side effects, you shouldn't do those things yet you do every day. Yet when it comes to doing something like intermittent fasting, which is a pretty potent anti-aging technology, what are the side effects? What if it's not safe? Like, what you're doing isn't safe because it leads you to basically start to become infirm around 60 and spend the last 20 or 25 years of your life on a creeping slow decline into feeling like crap. Okay, that is what your current path is until you do something about it. And the hard part for me is that when I was 300 pounds in my 20s, I did what they said. Oh yeah, I'll go on a semi-vegetarian, I'll go on a low-fat, low-calorie diet, and I'll work out an hour and a half a day, 6 days a week. And I did it reliably for 18 months. I did not miss a day, 6 days a week. And at the end of that time, I'm at Carl's Jr. with my friends, and they're eating double Western bacon cheeseburgers. I'm having the chicken salad with no chicken and no dressing. And I looked at him like, I'm fat. It's not fair. I am eating less than my thin friends, and I work out more than all of them put together. And they look like that, and I look like this. And I just thought, clearly I'm eating too much lettuce because that's what we're taught. And the reality was there were other things wrong with my biology, and eating a low-fat, low-calorie diet was not at all what my body needed. And I've lost 100 pounds since then, and I don't work out anywhere near as much. But that was following 30-year-old advice that clearly didn't work. And it goes so far as I got a chance to ask the first guy to have his human genome sequenced. Cost $100 million, Craig Venter. I said, Craig, you have 25 years of data on the human genome. What recommendations would you make for people based on all you know, even if you're not sure, but just the ones that are most likely to be true, or should we all just have pizza and beer and wait for more research? And he looks at me and he goes, let's talk about it over pizza and beer. And I'm like, this is not how it's supposed to be. So it's your job, it's my job, it's everyone's job to say, you know what? Given the state of knowledge now, given how I feel, I am going to do the thing that gives me the most energy and makes me feel the best. And if I don't feel good the next day, it's absolutely my fault. It means I did something wrong and I'm going to figure out what it is. And we do something different the next day. And if you just do that, it doesn't take that much work, especially given all the knowledge that you're sharing, that we're all sharing. Heck, read Superhuman. There's a bunch of stuff in there. But whatever it is, those are going to make it so the choices you decide to try are much more likely to be beneficial ones. And if all of a sudden you go from, you know, I had to give myself a 6 out of 10 on how I feel every day, now I'm at an 8 out of 10 and I spent the same amount of money and the same amount of energy, that is some of the most precious stuff you could ever do. And that's what's lacking. And because it's academic fear that drives that.
So I want to go back to the beginning, and you presented an important distinction in the book, and you've been talking about it recently. I called you the godfather of biohacking. And really what your key distinction that you start the book off is that human beings have always been biohacking, right? You just don't think of it that way. And tell us about that. And you have this great story of of fire that opens up the book. Sure. I would love for you to share a version of that you can for the podcast.
Imagine a caveman named Thog, and he's sitting in a warm cave with a fire, and he says, "All right, it's winter. I'm going to go to the next cave over." And he puts on his animal skin and runs through the snow to the next cave and says, "You know, hey, I have this new fire thing, and I'm using it to keep my family warm. Like, come see it." So he brings the other caveman in, and he says, "Oh, well, yeah, it's warm in here, but we all know fire is dangerous because we've seen forest fires. And besides, if you have fire, it might not be fair. You know, what if we don't all have fire?" And no thanks, I'll pass. More research is needed, basically. Right? And one of those two cavemen is our ancestor, right? And textiles, the ability to wear clothes, blankets. These are biohacking technologies. Biohacking, as I defined it, and now it's in the English dictionary. It is the art and science of changing the environment around you and inside of you so that you have control of your biology. You know what the cavemen wanted? They wanted to be warm. So they changed the environment around them by putting a blanket on or by lighting a fire. And we have been doing things to save effort, save energy, feel better, and live longer every single day since then. And for some reason, probably because of marketing or something, I can't even explain it. In the last 50 years or so, it seems like we lost that. And all of a sudden, it's about this, let's worry. Look, we all want to save time. We all want more energy. Everything we've ever done as humans, all of engineering came about from a group of people who were practicing anti-aging medicine. We talk about alchemy, the alchemists. Well, those are guys with pointy hats, you know, the Merlin and wizards and Game of Thrones or something like that. Alchemy was about anti-aging. It was about cracking the laws of nature so that we could understand it. And all the alchemists were pursuing immortality. And Francis Bacon, most of the names of science that are revered in the West were studying anti-aging and alchemy. And there are threads of this that run through Ayurveda, that run through traditional Chinese medicine, run through South American shamanism. So we have thousands of years of anti-aging research that have become built into our traditions. And then in the last 50 or 70 years, we decided we would just crush those and eat a bunch of garbage processed food and tell ourselves, oh, that all this decline in aging, all this bad things happening, they just happen. There's nothing you can do about them. Food doesn't have an impact on you. I had doctors tell me that. Just eat less. That's all that matters. But the science is very clear. What you eat determines how you will die.
Powerful. And I think what was powerful for me is that I knew that, and I come from a tradition of the Vedic tradition and Ayurveda, and I grew up with those sorts of things. And I think when I look back at like the last 50, 100 years, there's so many factors that all happened, a lot of them beautiful, through the growth of technology and our ability to live the life that we have now and have lights and the internet and cameras and other stuff and the Industrial Revolution. It all changed so quickly that there's a distancing between doing something and noticing the difference. It's almost like our diet and lifestyle has changed so much that even if people alter something a little bit small, first of all, they look around and everybody's feeling fat and sick.
Right.
Right. So you just feel normal. It's just a normal sign of aging. If everybody's in the nursing home, you forget about a time that people weren't. So it's almost like as a society, we've lost our memory and we have to be retold that, hey, guys, it wasn't always this way.
It wasn't that way. And we also have this crazy, it's a very Western scientific notion, and it's full of scientific hubris and arrogance. And it's that I'm only going to change one variable. I'm going to control for all the other variables.
In a way, you know, I met Craig Venter once. I don't know him well, but it's sort of like, from what I've heard about the project and the continuation of that and other people that are in the traditional space of longevity, we're looking for the one thing that leads to all the answers.
And it's such crap, because I come from a background of computer hacking. I used to teach at the University of California. I ran the program for web and internet systems engineering. So the internet is a distributed system of millions and millions of computers that all do different things at different times, yet somehow you can influence it. The cells in your body are the same way. Cells have anywhere from 100 to 15,000 ancient bacteria embedded in them that run a bacteria decision-making process. And there's quadrillion cells or so in your body, depending on how you want to count them. And you look at all this stuff and you go, wow, there's a lot of complexity in this system. What makes you think that one thing is going to change a system that complex, right? What makes you think that one thing is going to build a road? It's not one thing. You needed a steamroller, you needed a shovel, you needed raw materials. So changing one variable and expecting something to happen is actually less productive than masturbation. You feel really good about yourself for doing it, but nothing productive happened at the end. So here's what you do if you're a biohacker. And that's one of the reasons I helped to create that field, is that it was born out of frustration because I said, I'm going to try these vitamins. I'm a scientist. I'll try vitamin C for a month, and then I'll try vitamin B for a month, and I'm going to see which one works. And then I did the math one day and I said, I'm going to try one nutrient per month for the rest of my life and it won't be done. But it turns out we understand pathways, and you could say you need this one and this one and this one and this one. So the way you get results, if you want to fix your brain, you do everything that you can afford that is likely to work all at the same time. And when you do that, you wake up the next day and go, I got my brain back. And then you say, I wonder if they're all useful. Let me stop doing some of those and see if I go backwards. But if you're hoping you'll get the result by only doing one thing at a time, you're not getting it right. In Superhuman, like, look, there's four things that are likely to kill you if you're average, right? And it's diabetes, it's heart disease, it's cancer and Alzheimer's. Those are going to get most people if they're average. But let's say that you avoid dying of those things, which is a small portion of the book. What are the seven things that are going to make you old, the things you must manage? Now, if you have that Western scientific humor that says it's one thing, okay, which one thing do you do to maintain your car? Do you replace the tires when they're worn out, or do you change the oil? Maybe you do both. And so the academic discipline that says, I want to boil things down to figure out the one thing, is useful and valuable. And it's how we discover knowledge. But the way we get results as clinicians in clinics working with patients, the way we get results as people caring for our system, is to do what works and then figure out which of the things was the most important and which combination is important. And when the researchers say, I controlled for all variables, did you know, Drew, that a major variable that no one tracked and no one understood was that when women feed mice in the lab, their hormones are different than when men feed mice?
Yeah, I had never heard of it before, and I'm pretty deep in this space. I actually heard it first when I listened to your podcast with Dax Shepard.
Nice.
And you could hear, they were like, wait, what?
And also, how many times have you read a paper on PubMed on mice where they told you the type of lighting used above the mouse's cage? Because I could show you a lot of studies about fluorescent lighting, circadian timing, and oh wait, are mice nocturnal animals? I wonder if that is an important variable, because it is, and it wasn't tracked. Oh, and by the way, how many studies have you seen that look at the phase of the moon? Because my wife's an emergency room doctor, and any ER doctor or cop will tell you that when there's a full moon, people go bonkers and the ER is full. So that has some biological effect. Was it tracked? No. So we just believe that we control for all variables, but you cannot control for all variables in life because we don't know which ones matter yet.
Freakonomics, great podcast. I don't know if you listen to it. They did a whole series called Bad Medicine. It's a 3-part series. And in one of the series that they did, I think it was the third one, they basically said that a big meta-analysis of other studies came out and said that upwards of, like, I'm going to put in the show notes so that you can see exactly the percentage, but I know that it was higher than 30 and I think it was lower than 60% of the studies that were published out that they tried to replicate were not replicatable.
Mm-hmm.
So studies get
60.
Published. Yeah. Studies get published all the time. And just because they get published and they're peer reviewed, when somebody tries to go back and do that study, they don't necessarily get the same results.
And sometimes it's crazy. Like in the history of the opiate receptor, just discovering the opiate receptor, there was a major mistake made over sodium versus calcium EDTA. Because the first person who wrote the study just wrote EDTA and didn't define which metal ion was on it. Okay. Little stuff like that happens all the time. And so, yeah, it can't be replicated. Or maybe it was something else because they had a woman feed the mouse and they got results. And it's our job to understand what those are. But as humans that have onboard systems and the ability to order lab tests, we can now say, you know what, the study of mice says this ought to work. Let's try it for a day or a month or a year, and let's track our results. And if we get the results that were predicted by the study with a reasonable theory of causation, we can say without a double-blind clinical trial, damn, that worked. And when I stopped doing it, it went away. And when I did it again, it started again. So this is how humans behave. And the fact that we're sort of handcuffed So there's no double-blind placebo-controlled trial. There never will be a double-blind placebo-controlled trial of jumping out of an airplane without a parachute, right? Because it's stupid. We can see that it works or it doesn't work. And many of the things, even in superhuman, I talk about ozone therapy. And ozone is something that most people think of as an environmental pollutant. It's a strong oxidant that tells the cells in your body that they better wake up and start making antioxidants again. It's a signaling molecule. So I write about that stuff. Who would have ever thought that that was a meaningful thing? But it turns out there's studies and then it works and people who try it, including, you know, Mark Hyman.
Yeah.
He just talked about it on his show. And for me, when I did ozone therapy for the first time, like, I got my brain back in one time. It was only for 5 minutes. This is the best 5 minutes I've had in 5 years. And the next day I did ozone therapy and I got 10 minutes and I did it every night for 18 months and I got my brain back permanently, right? Along with some other things. But here's the thing. If I had done just one thing, I might have never gotten it. Right. So you got to do what works and you can tell.
Not that studies are not great, because I think also the backlash, I mean, there's a lot of different theories out there, including some conspiracy theories. Some of the backlash to ozone early on came from what I was reading, and you might know more, so please chime in especially like the 50s, 60s, there's a group of people that were breathing ozone and didn't realize it could like puncture their like lungs. And it's like the way that it happened, and there was this backlash that happened versus now how it's done is not harmful. Do you know anything about this?
Yeah, if you breathe even small amounts of ozone, you will cough terribly and it stings and you'll retch. If you breathe slightly higher concentrations than that, you'll throw up and double over. And if you breathe more than that, you'll die.
Yeah.
So anyone who's breathing ozone is doing exceptionally low amounts, like from an air filter or a thunderstorm, or they will be profoundly sick from it. So if that was going on, it was probably an industrial pollutant in a place where people are getting chronic exposure to it. But the way ozone therapy is practiced, you never get it in the lungs because it destroys the lining of the lungs. But if you get it in pretty much anywhere else on the body, including through the skin, rectal, vaginal, or intravenous, it just tells the cells in the body, hey, here's some extra electrons. By the way, could you turn on glutathione production? And could the weak cells that can't make antioxidants, could they just die so young ones can be generated? So I'll tell you, in superhuman, you want to live a long time. If you do an occasional treatment of ozone, it is going to knock down a lot of the microbes that grow in us as we age. Things that take 20, 30 years to really have an impact on you. Things that live inside your blood vessels. Things that live in your collagen matrix. They're a normal part of life. So if you smack them over the head at the same time you tell your cells, hey, here's a shot of oxygen and here's a shot of oxidants that lasted for 1 or 2 seconds, it's basically weightlifting for your cell membranes, and it's amazing how it makes you feel.
I wasn't sick and I wasn't dealing with mold or anything like that that you dealt with, and also Mark, you know, I know his ozone experience really deeply, but I was doing it for maintenance, and I haven't done it probably in about a year. Actually, that's not true. I was at our Ultra Wellness Center clinic and I did it with Mark, and I felt great. You know, I've done it multiple times as more of a maintenance thing.
Once every few months, once every 6 months when you're younger, it will keep you younger. And you do it after a flight, it turns you back on. And to this day, I mean, I've had medical ozone equipment at home for almost 20 years. And if I come back from a flight, and I travel just crazy amounts for Bulletproof. And I mean, we're in LA today. I was in San Francisco yesterday and Seattle the day before. And I just found London the week before that. So when I come home, I do ozone therapy. I'll do rectal ozone. And it takes all of 5 minutes to do it. And you feel better, faster. And energy is precious, because if I have energy, I get to play with my kids. If I don't have energy, I take a nap.
So I want to set up a framework for the conversation that we're having, because I know we're talking about a lot of different things, and I can see people's eyes and ears and brains lighting up. So I started off with first identifying the fact that a crucial thing that you talk about in the book is that biohacking, which seems like this buzzword and this crazy thing that's related to technology and hacking, which, you know, it can be that too, is really this thing that we've been doing forever. And if we can step back into that basic idea and that framework, which is it's simply about working on changing the environment around you to live better, and your definition, live longer, then, and we don't just wait for things to be ultimately proven. And we know that medical research can often be 12 to 30 years behind the late, we know that the implementation of it at the doctor's office can be 12 to 30 years behind. Then we can try things and see firsthand, how do we feel, right? So that was the first thing that was there. The second thing that you talked about, which is it's not one thing that is going to make you feel better. And then I want to go back to your story. In the case of you, and we talked about your story in our first podcast, in the case of you, it wasn't one thing that was going to make you better, because it also wasn't one thing that made you sick. I'm just using in the air quotes, right?
Yep.
So talk about the core factors that were going on for you. You talked about being obese. You talked about your brain not working. So what did you find out that were the key pillars for you that were causing what you were experiencing then?
I grew up in a basement that had been flooded and not remediated. So we know I had toxic mold, and I had these chronic nosebleeds, like sometimes 5-6 times a day. Just my nose just start bleeding. It was really irritating. But this is a classical sign of mold exposure. Frequent bruising for no reason. Stretch marks that developed for apparently no reason. I wasn't getting very fat as a kid, but I'm just riddled with stretch marks around my midsection. And if people don't believe that, I was in men's health with my shirt off and abs. And if you look closely, like, there's the stretch marks. They're still there. They just fade with time. Whether that's something that is very hard to hack, I've looked into that. Not that I'm worried about the cosmetics. I'm just like, how do I achieve victory over those things that have been here since I was, you know, 14 or something? And what was going on there was toxic mold, or just any mold, its mortal enemy is bacteria. That's why penicillin comes from mold. In fact, most antibiotics do. So our cells are powered by ancient bacteria, and molds make toxins to kill bacteria, including ancient ones. So there was a war going on inside my cells because of the environment that I was in. And I've done a documentary. It's called Moldy Movie. Mark is in it. And moldymovie.com, free screening, check it out. But here's the deal. 100 million homes have this problem. And if you want to not get old, you want to have a brain that works, you need to not live in toxic mold. And it affects different people differently because of these weird cellular pathways. I also, it turns out, had high mercury and lead levels that I diagnosed in my 20s. Likely, I got them when I was younger. My parents owned a gold mine, believe it or not. They co-owned it with 5 other families. That sounds really swanky. I lived in New Mexico, and that meant we had, you know, a couple hundred acres where we would go dig holes on weekends. But I was exposed to mercury through that. Which was probably more of an effect than we would have known at the time. And so I had those going on. I also had chronic sinus infections every month for 15 years. And I took antibiotics every month for that because that's what the doctors told me. Not recognizing that chronic strep throats and sinusitis are purely symptoms of toxic mold exposure. So now I've ruined my gut bacteria, both by living in a toxic house and by taking antibiotics that keep knocking them down over and over. I developed all kinds of autoimmunity. I had arthritis diagnosed in my knees when I was 14, and I just started gaining weight no matter what I did. And I would exercise. I would try to change how I would eat. I would do all these things, and you start to feel like a failure because you're like, I'm doing everything right. By the time I was 20, I had my first knee surgery. I had 3 knee surgeries on one of my knees because it would just collapse when I would walk. I mean, I was pretty damn sick. And then I went into, metabolic disorders, prediabetes, medical blood tests showing high risk of stroke and heart attack before I'm 30. And it just went on and on. And here it is the whole time saying, I thought I was doing the right thing. And it was when I got really serious. I'm like, screw this noise. Everything I've done that the doctors have told me to do and regular magazines and things, it hasn't worked. And it's not that I didn't do it. It isn't that I didn't try hard enough. It's that it actually didn't work. It was bad advice. And what broke the camel's back is I went into the doctor and I said, I don't know what's going on here. I just moved into a condo that turns out has Stachybotrys in the bedroom, which is the worst of the worst toxic molds. It's just disabling. And all of my symptoms came back that I thought I was done with. And I put on 30 pounds in about a month and a half. I'm just like, what's going on? And I feel like I'm hungover all the time, not understanding all this. I said, well, doctor, vitamin C seems to make me feel better. And he said, well, how much are you taking? I said, well, I take 3 grams a day, and I feel like I get a little bit of a lift from that. And he said, you have to stop. It could kill you. Mm-hmm. And I looked at him, and I said, what about Linus Pauling? Linus Pauling, 2 Nobel Prizes, 90 grams of vitamin C a day. And the doctor looks at me and goes, Linus who? And I looked at him, and I said, you're fired. And I had never paid him. It went on my credit report for 7 years, but I never paid him because I'm like, I'm not spending my hard-earned money on your shitty advice. And I was actually really angry at the medical profession. I'm married to a doctor now. For a while, until I
finally said, I actually have diagnosed myself. I have one of these seven things going on. And I looked and I found what we would now call a functional medicine doctor. And I went in and I said, I don't know what it is, but I think it's in this order. I want this lab test from this lab and this treatment plan, if that's what it is. And she's like, wow, okay, you've done your homework. Why don't we start with the one that I think is most likely and we'll do some lab tests for that. And then I was like, oh, thank God. Someone who will believe me, who doesn't look at me and say, oh, sure, you're exercising every day. Sure, you want a low-fat diet. You're eating Snickers bars. You probably have a car full of them. That was the treatment I was getting. So I think the medical profession has become much better and healthier and more able to listen to people. And when you go to the functional medicine side, that's all that you have to do is sit down and spend that first hour listening, and you learn so much.
And that was the start of you spending $1 million on biohacking your own self and body?
I was pretty pissed.
Yeah. So you talked about these seven items that were there. Take us to that appointment and some of the first things. What was one of the first labs that came back and the things that you started to notice that this doctor came back to you and showed you that was going on?
The doctor said, you have Lyme disease. And I said, well, okay. I've certainly been bitten by a lot of ticks. As a kid growing up in New Mexico, I'm spending time in the forest, or more likely the desert. That just happens. But I never had any rash. And I said, all right, let's try the antibiotics for that. It didn't work. It made things worse. And I did a lot more research, though, and I started understanding, okay, Lyme disease and toxic mold go really well together. And to this day, 80% of people who think they have Lyme disease actually have toxic mold exposure, because you will get better from Lyme disease most of the time if you are not simultaneously exposed to toxic mold.
Because toxic mold is like a constant suppression on your immune system.
Exactly.
You know, your body's trying to, you know, have the best immune system possible, and the mold is constantly just beating it down.
Something like 90 to 95% of people listening to the show, if you were to look for Lyme DNA in their urine, they have it. It's present in their body. It's just not doing anything because your immune system works. It's when something takes out the immune system that the Lyme gets to be a lot stronger.
Similar to, like, a lot of people get diagnosed with H. pylori. Like, yep. I think like 60% of the population has it according to the stats that are out there. But then the question always in functional medicine is that, is it expressing itself or can you just live with it, right?
Yeah, it's not causing any harm. And what was going on with me, and what since then I've had guests on Bulletproof Radio who've done the genetic expression differences to show the slight difference between toxic mold and Lyme, and that most of the time it is toxic mold. So they also tested me. The time they didn't test me for toxic mold, they tested me for Candida, and that was on my list. It turns out Candida and toxic mold have a lot of similarities. Candida is a yeast in the fungal species. And there was another doctor who said, well, Dave, this is weird. He said, my patients get better. This is a guy who was a Johns Hopkins ENT surgeon, quit his practice. He said, I do surgery on people's sinuses. They don't get better. I'm done. So he became an acupuncturist, a naturopath, even a homeopath, which is, as a computer scientist, like the least likely thing for me to believe. And he's though very credible. And I said, all right, you try your stuff. I'll take whatever drops you want. I also spend my disbelief. And it didn't work. None of the stuff. I mean, some of it actually helped. Glutathione intravenously helped. The metal chelation he did helped. But finally, he sat me down and he said, Dave, I haven't really seen this before, but you're not getting better. I don't understand it, because all the things that should work aren't working. I want to run an AIDS test. And he said, I don't think you have it, but I cannot explain your immune suppression. It's so weird. So we ran it. I didn't have HIV and didn't have AIDS, obviously. But he did run an allergy test that showed I was allergic to 8 of the top 10 species of toxic mold. So now we have a smoking gun that I have lived in houses that had toxic mold. And I'm like, oh, this makes so much sense. And all the pieces came together and you look at what it does. It disables systems in the body, the same systems that get disabled as you age. So for me, I was treated to early onset aging with the cognitive problems, chronic fatigue syndrome, which is something, I'm just too tired to get out of bed sort of thing. The joint pain, the muscle pain, I don't know why I put my car keys in the fridge kind of stuff, all of it. And I don't have it anymore, but I know what it's like.
Mm. So mold was really like one of the first pillars for you.
Yep.
That you went down. So let's link that into the seven pillars of aging that you referenced earlier. So zombie cells, mitochondrial mutations, shrinking tissues, these come straight from your book, cellular straitjackets, and extracellular junk. So which one of these does mold affect?
Every single one of them.
So let's just start off with the first one, shrinking tissues.
Well, as we age, we actually run out of stem cells and we have less tissue. So you've seen older people where they have very thin skin. And this is because your collagen replacement rate goes down over time unless you do something about it. And you have something called sarcopenia, muscle loss. And part of this is you used up the stem cells you had. And part of this is other changes that happen with aging. So when people are exposed to toxic mold, they tend to lose muscle and gain a lot of fat. They get fat the way I was fat, surprisingly. So you will see striated muscle where there's a lot of fat in the muscle. And you'll see actually inability to put on muscle because of chronic inflammation. And so that's one of the ones where people who are chronically exposed to any kind of poison like that, their body simply won't be able to synthesize protein because it's too busy making enzymes to try and detoxify. And then you get into these other ones. One of my favorite ones is the cellular straitjackets. And a lot of people have heard of amyloid plaque because they say, oh, that's what causes Alzheimer's disease. It's a symptom of Alzheimer's disease. And what amyloids are throughout the body are essentially cellular level calluses or scar tissue from chronic inflammation. So we all know if you do something and you have a bad knee or a bad elbow or something like that, it gets scar tissue and it just doesn't work as well as it did before. If you are doing things, whether it's being in a toxic mold environment, eating tons of things that expose you to toxic mold, like even fish, that expose you to toxic metals, or you're getting terrible sleep, you're eating a lot of sugar, you're eating fried food, you're smoking, you're drinking. All of those things cause chronic inflammation, which itself is caused by a decline in your cell's ability to take food and air and turn them into energy. And when there's chronic inflammation, it will create these plaques. And over the course of decades, your cells become less flexible. And when they're less flexible, they're less functional. When they're less functional, you start to go down that decline of aging.
And the plaque is, I mean, there's a lot of different thoughts on it, but in a way it's less, it's more of a reaction. It's like a survival mechanism. It's not the problem. The plaque is sort of part of this thing, but the question is always like, what is your body trying to survive?
Yes. Right? And this isn't the kind of plaque inside your arteries we're talking about, just right. for people listening. This is an amyloid plaque, it's called. So basically these are cross-linked proteins in your cells that wouldn't have been there had there not been chronic inflammation. And autoimmunity is a major trigger. It's something where your body gets inflamed by things in your own body. And if you have that going on, which I did, I was diagnosed with Hashimoto's in my mid-20s, which is when your immune system attacks your thyroid gland, you end up with even more of these plaques throughout your body. So your job is, how do I turn off inflammation? And if I can do that via almost any mechanism, and usually food is at the core of it, food and sleep and things like that, you will actually live longer because you'll have less of these plaques. That's one of the seven pillars of aging that you've just hacked.
And you know, your story involves mold, but it's not a book about mold.
No,
it's really, you're
not
using
at all.
That example yeah. as an example of these different factors in our life that can trigger these big killers that are out there,
yeah.
these chronic diseases for individuals.
Mold, for me, triggered early onset aging.
Right.
And all these things that you're supposed to get when you're 60 or 70 in my late teens and 20s. And so it provided an opportunity for me to figure out how to hack them, or as I like to say, to die trying, because there was nothing more important than that. So I'm not going back. That's why I wrote Superhuman. You don't have to go there. Trust me, you don't want to go there.
So zooming out a little bit, you know, you on your journey ended up at this functional medicine doctor. You started digging in and you started piecing together something that Linus Pauling really started loudly talking about in his later years, which is this idea of systems-based biology.
Yes.
Go ahead.
No, I'm just agreeing with you. It's so good you said that. Keep going.
So functional medicine, which Dr. Hyman and many other people practice out there, and you know, they have a little bit of an integrative medicine too, and there's different methodology that are out there. It's all based on this idea of systems-based biology, coined by Linus Pauling, the idea that you can't separate the body into these isolated organs that just operate on their own. You can't just see a cardiologist if you want to look at your heart health. You have to think about, how does your microbiome in your mouth affect it, because the bacteria can end up in your heart. You have to think about how your gut bacteria affects your brain, that you are bigger than just these individual organs. You are an entire system. So was that the first time for you working with this practitioner that you saw intuitively what I know, somebody's actually helping me see that all these systems are being affected?
It's funny. Linus Pauling was the father of orthomolecular medicine. which was the name for functional or integrative medicine before we had that name. So this is the people who knew Linus were the people I was interviewing and interacting with at the anti-aging nonprofit. And in fact, the very first practitioners that I found were orthomolecular. And now that's a word that you don't see as commonly used anymore. And functional is more systems-based. But you're right, Linus Pauling was the first guy to really talk about that systems biology. And you'll see the Institute for Systems Biology at major universities now where we're realizing that, wow, we're not meat robots. But keep in mind, my grandmother's a nuclear engineer. Grandfather's a PhD chemist. I'm a computer science guy. My whole family is engineers. So I had that mindset, not a medical mindset, but a meat robot mindset, where we're just a collection of parts, right? All the consciousness that you have is just thoughts in your brain, right? And it's purely resonant there. And there's no such thing as a field effect. Your brain doesn't do anything outside the body. You know, you pull your heart out and put a pump in there, and it's exactly the same thing. And this is complete bullshit. That is not how the body works. It's an incredibly complex system with individual localized nodes of awareness and consciousness inside your cells. And each cell has its own awareness and consciousness. And they're stupid and they run tiny little decision-making things. But when you roll that up millions of times a second times quadrillions of cells, you get these amazing automatic behaviors that then you feel guilty about. And they're usually, I wanted to punch that guy, I wanted to eat that donut, and I wanted to have sex with that person. And you're going, geez, that's everything I've ever done that I'm ashamed of rolled up. And it's all subcellular activities. So how are you going to say, based on that, oh, consciousness is just in the brain and we're just meat robots and you can pull one part out, you can pull another part out. That's not how it works. And it's so provable that there's a book from a guy who did organ transplants for most of his career. And I'll probably think of its name in a minute. And he says, you know what? I didn't want to write about this till I was done doing surgeries because they would have taken my medical license. But here's what I found. When I take an organ from one person and I put it in another person, that person will take on characteristics of the person whose organ they got. And he tells the story of a cowboy who gets the heart of a 20-year-old woman. And suddenly this 50-year-old cowboy is taking scented bubble bath after his surgery. And his family's like, what is wrong with you? And he's like, I don't know. I just want to do it. Right? So it is a complex distributed system. And it is so stupid to say, I am just a kidney specialist and I only look at that, when you don't look at why is the kidney inflamed. It's part of a system. And the scary thing and the thing that gives me the most hope is we know very well that the system of our bodies does not end at our skin, and it does not end even 1 foot or 10 feet away from you. We can measure the magnetic field that comes off your heart multiple feet away from you. And we know its shape and we know the direction of the current flow. This is a real thing. We know it's tilted 8 degrees to the left. So there is a field effect that humans all have. In fact, you can measure the effect on other people from someone who has a highly coherent heart rate. You can measure the effect of a human heart rate on a horse that they haven't touched, because the horse's heart rate will change to match the human's. So we know that. And we know that the environment around us changes our biology. So whether you walk through a forest, there is something in superhuman about natural killer cells. I've had my blood extracted, cultured for 6 weeks. They grew billions of natural killer cells and injected them back in, which they go through and they hunt down zombie cells and they hunt down precancerous cells and they remove them with extreme discretion. So I gave myself a 20-year younger nervous system. Okay, that's an expensive treatment that is usually only done for people who have cancer or something. This wasn't about cancer. This was just about having a young immune system. Well, there's another way to raise your natural killer cells by 20%. It's called going for a walk in an evergreen forest. And I found a study about Hiroki spruce essential oils. And those oils are shown in a study to raise your natural killer cells by 20%. So maybe $20 worth of essential oils might be worth sprinkling on your pillow sometimes. Or maybe you should go for a walk in a forest. But if you think that the system of your biology ends at your body, you are wrong. The world around you programs you way more than you know it. So the only logical thing you can do is you can start to affect the world around you so it will affect you the way you want it to be. And that starts with not polluting stuff. And it starts with being nice to people around you because they're more likely to be nice to you back and to other people. And it starts with making sure everyone around you is well fed because people who eat the right foods are nicer to each other. Guess how long you'll live if you're surrounded by nice people versus angry people? You'll live longer. Like, you win when you fix the world around you.
It's so true. And, you know, you've divided the book into like how to avoid the things that are like affecting you. An example, you talked about like mold and or repair the damage.
Yep.
And then you've also gone into like a whole section of things that you can add in to like completely level up. And we're not going to go too much into food because we talk a lot about food, sure, in this podcast. And we talked about a lot about food in our last,
correct,
interview and the brain and everything that. Anybody who wants to listen to that, you can go back and listen to that podcast. But just like you mentioned, these natural killer cells. What are some of the other technologies that you're focused on right now that are related to longevity?
Well, I'm not going to talk about bulletproof coffee and ketones because we've talked about it before.
About that, yes.
Right. But it's massively important that you look at ketones and that you don't eat sometimes. And I've talked a little bit about intermittent fasting in the first book, the Bulletproof Diet book, really helped to put that on the radar. And there's so much new research has come out in the last 5 years. So part of this is sometimes don't eat, which is different than talking about food. But the other one is light. Circadian biology, our knowledge in the last 8 years has just changed dramatically for this. So you'll see I'm wearing these cool yellow glasses. These are made by True Dark. It's a company that I founded. And there's a couple different patents with my name on them around manipulating the color of light that comes into your eyes. It's not just blue blocking, it goes beyond that. And I've been able to measurably double my deep sleep if I use the glasses designed for sleep by True Dark. And if you want to really function well, fixing your sleep is one of the biggest things you can do. So I talk about the technology of doing that, and I also talk about light therapy. If you'd like to have skin that maintains its elasticity and doesn't get super thin over time, you can use red and infrared and even amber light therapy. You can spend a few minutes every now and then shining a light on your face or on your body that has incredible systemic effects, including on the microbiome, on your bone density, on your testosterone levels in men, on your progesterone levels in women, just from light on your skin. And people don't know that. So maybe in the morning when you're drinking your coffee, you might want to have some light therapy. Is that going to radically change how you feel 20 years from now and how you look? Actually, it probably will. And it's not very expensive because you buy a light therapy device and you can use it every day for free.
I've been using the True Dark glasses. Your team was kind enough to send some over to us. So thank you for that.
Did you notice the difference?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Okay. I know you have different versions. There's ones you can wear like for like computer glasses.
Yeah, that's
like
what I'm wearing now. Yeah.
There's ones you can wear that are like mid sort of ones.
The sunsets. Yeah.
And then like evening ones. And I saw you were rocking a few on ones on the flight. Those were like the really dark ones, right?
I wore those flying to London. And I flew from Vancouver to London. So that's the worst jet lag you can get. And my Aura Ring showed I got 2 hours of deep sleep on the airplane. Which is incredible because most 20-year-olds don't get 2 hours of deep sleep in 8 hours. And I wore those glasses for 2 hours before I boarded the plane. And I wore them when I was on the plane until I went to sleep. And they just, for me, they're like Valium or noise canceling headphones for my eyes. And there's good science behind that, but it's not just blocking blue. It's blocking all of the things that, get this, 10 years ago, we didn't even understand that 5% of the cells in your retina, they collect light, but you can't see the light because it goes around the optic nerve into the timing system of the brain. Mm. So we just said, what colors do those cells care about? Let's block those colors. And we did that. And I tricked my brain into thinking I was sitting in pitch black darkness, even though I could still watch a movie.
Fascinating. You know, when you were on the podcast last time, you said something really key. You were like, people always ask you, like, what supplements do I take? And you said, what I take now is made for my body, the insults that I went through, the genes that I have, the things that I go through. And I could tell you, and you do talk about some of that, but you need to figure out what's right for you. And also you need to figure out what place in your journey you're in. Because if you're overwhelmed and you think that you have to do everything perfect and you have to do everything right, you're going to quit before you start because you're just judging yourself all the time for not making progress. So when you talk about all these different things that are the tools in people's toolbox that are out there, how do we teach people prioritization of experimentation?
There's it's one of the first two chapters in Superhuman. We talk about return on investment, and it's teaching you how to think about that. And return on investment has a couple things. It's what are the returns you're looking for and what are you investing? And I will argue very passionately that there's only one thing you ever invest, and it's energy. You do not invest time or money, because if you have plenty of energy, then time becomes valuable. But if you have no energy, time is useless. And if you have no time, money is useless. And if you have no energy, money is useless. So it turns out energy is what allows you to create time and use time, and energy is what allows you to create money. So then now you're saying, okay, how much work is it for me to do this thing that's going to make me live longer? And you could say, well, that costs $100 a month. I don't want to invest that right now because it takes too much energy to make $100 right now, and I don't need that benefit. But you could also say, I feel like crap all the time. I'm in constant pain. And if I spend $100 a month, the pain goes away. And then it's worth it because it gave me energy back, right? So energy now is what you're investing in first. And when you have so much of that, you start saying, wow, I think I'm going to start investing for the future. And use energy as the lens of what you're investing and what you're getting back. And you might say, actually, what I really wanted was abs. I have enough energy. And that's cool. Your return is measured in abs. And then you adjust your investment of energy, time, and money in those things. So you just have to think about that and just say, you know what? There is an infinite amount of technology and things that you could do. I have a $1 million lab at my house full of anti-aging technologies, full of recovery technologies. We opened Upgrade Labs here in Santa Monica where you can go in and use this stuff. I have a problem. I could spend 8 hours a day at my house using recovery technologies. Do you think I'd do that? No. So the challenge for Upgrade Labs was, how do I figure out how to create the best path through this stack of technology? So when someone walks in the door, I can say, what do you want? And where are you right now? Do this, do this, do this. And that's going to give you the highest returns in the least possible amount of time. You have to look at what you do that way, whether it's entertainment, whether it's what you put on your plate, or whether it's an anti-aging technology. It's always that way of thinking.
One shout out that I want to give you from this really did come directly from you, is that I've been eating and focusing on my diet and health and everything for pretty much since like the year 2000, when I realized that dairy was causing an inflammatory effect and was leading to my very like cystic acne that I had
right
at the time. And so I've paid attention. I put a lot of effort and energy into that, cleaned up my diet. I never dealt with weight issues, yep, right? But I had my own health issues. My acne cleared up in a couple months, and that led to a lot of other improvements and advancements. But the one thing was, every so often, every year and a half, I would still get like sick. I had a lot of chronic sinus stuff when I was a kid, and I had strep throat and other things like that. I've done all the mold things. I tested my house for mold, got the mycotoxin test, other stuff. And one time I heard you in an interview say that basically talking about fried food and how damaging it was.
Yeah.
And I don't eat fried food regularly, even like that often, but every so often, like maybe every 3 months, I would be out with some friends and somebody would order like sweet potato fries,
right,
or something else that's fried, and you're going for like an experience. And almost immediately when I started looking at that, after I heard you talking about it, I noticed how quickly it would change the inflammation in my mouth and my throat.
Yes.
And then usually within a few days I would get sick.
Yeah.
And I cut out fried foods completely from my diet, and I made that a priority, and I haven't had anything fried in at least 2 years now, and I have not gotten sick.
It's so cool that you noticed that. And the crazy skill that I have is in the tech world, we call it event correlation. And it's just noticing that there's a relationship between events. And I don't know why I do it, but a lot of the writing that I do just on the blog, in fact, I'm doing more writing on the Dave Asprey blog now, where I can talk about stuff that isn't collagen and coffee and MCTs and things. It's about, hey, I noticed this and there's a rational reason, like there's a causative chain here. Maybe you would benefit from knowing that because no one told me this. And this is that passing on wisdom. And I love it to hear what you just said there, because I have the same experience. I mean, I'd like to eat the fried stuff, but even if I fry it at home in the best possible oils, it's still fried. It's still damaged. And I wake up the next morning, I'm like, wow, my grip strength is 20% below what it normally is. I feel a difference, because when you get used to feeling really good, you feel really good. And you can also look at yourself, look, do you want to be a high performance sports car? And if so, you keep the air pressure right in the tires, you use the good gas, and you take care of it, right? And if you want to be the beater pickup truck, like, okay, it never runs very well, and the steering's always been loose, and it usually stops when you put the brakes on, right? And if that's the bar you set for yourself, you probably can eat more crap, and you'll probably feel like crap more often, and you just get used to running at 60% of what you're capable of, and that becomes the normal. And what I found is that I keep thinking I'm at a new level and like this must be it. And you go, oh, wait, there's more. And then you get into things like neurofeedback. I run 40 years of Zen. I started a clinic, hired neuroscientists, built custom hardware and software for changing, not for treating diseases, not for treating abnormalities, but for finding, identifying, and accelerating the altered states of high performance. Because let's face it, performing really well is not average. It is an altered state. What I found there was very interesting from a superhuman anti-aging perspective. If I give people the right foods, the right mitochondrial enhancing substances, you know, the supplements that I formulate and manufacture, they can do 2.5 times more deep personal development meditation work with computers guiding them than if they don't do any of that. They come in eating their fried foods and whatever they eat. They simply don't have the mental and cognitive resilience to dig deep and reprogram the voice in their head. And who would have thought? So even willpower itself comes from subcellular biology, comes from what we eat, comes from how our cells work. More ability to make electrons from food and air equals more willpower, equals more ability to change yourself.
Well, it's a super exciting time in wellness and the ability for people to try and share their experiences. And the book is just such a great outline for helping you find the tools in your toolbox that help address the root issues that are there. Because everybody's dealing with these different root issues and factors. And whether you want to live to 180, that's somebody's goal. Whether somebody just wants to live better within whatever their framework is. Whether there's vanity metrics. And there's a whole section inside of there that is really exciting about gray hairs.
Oh, yeah.
If people have them or want to talk about addressing those. There's a lot of different approaches that can guide you down the journey to figure out what's useful to you. But I think the real core message that I took away from the book is that it's possible. There's people out there that are doing it. And a lot of this stuff is just, even the idea of like going back to my experience, not eating fried foods and seeing that effect that it has in your body, that didn't cost me anything. It probably saved me money.
And I mean, if people are watching the video, if they look at you, and can you zoom in? Can you zoom in on his face? Oh, man. All right. So here's the deal. You're 36. Okay. You have 37. Really 37, right? You have really good skin, right? And I mean, I can tell. I've done this anti-aging thing for a long time. Like you look at the wrinkles around your eyes. I can tell you eat the right kinds of fats. You don't eat a lot of fried food because your skin looks like someone who actually eats good stuff. And you mentioned you've had cystic acne. So it looks like you might have some scarring somewhere, but it's not apparent because you look around your eyes, you look at your forehead, you actually look like someone who eats good fats and doesn't eat bad fats. And part of the big thing in superhuman, the whole big thing about food pharmacy, the big thing about all of the stuff that we're working on is that, look, stop doing the stuff that harms you. Stop that first and then do all the crazy fancy stuff that's better. And you're the walking example there. By not doing something bad, you actually got good skin.
I love it. Thank you for that compliment. And it's so important for people to step into that and you meet them where they are, following your recommendations, Dr. Hyman's recommendations, food first, right? Food and mindset. I think those things go together. In the last podcast that we had, you talked about really gratitude as being one of the big components.
Yeah.
To make the world a better place and to make it a better place for you. Dave, if you have, you know, if somebody is in a place where they're suffering and they're thinking about, like, you know, maybe they weren't as bad as where you were, where your brain was broken, you lost your keys.
It sucked.
You're dealing with a lot of different stuff. And they're just trying to step into the first place of loving themselves a little bit more so they can invest this time and energy into the recommendations that you talk about in the book. What's one recommendation you would have for them? For somebody who's beat themselves up so much that they've failed before they've gotten started because they haven't given themselves that self-love. What's your recommendation for them?
Well, you could get up in the morning You could look in the mirror and you could tell yourself you are enough, right? And right after you do that, make fun of yourself for setting the bar so low, because that's dumb, okay? You are way more than enough. And if someone tells you to set the bar, oh, I just want enough energy to get through the day, screw that noise. Like, be greedy and just say, you know what? I want enough energy to completely fly through the day and have so much energy left at the end of the night that I do something more fun. And you make that your reality. You make that your goal. You don't make it just getting by. And so much of the time when I found, I'm like, I just want to feel good. And that was wrong. I wanted to actually be superhuman, but I didn't have the balls to admit it to myself. And so you're not going to reach for it. And newsflash, if you set a really audacious goal, you might not actually make the entire goal. So if your goal is, I just want to be enough, you might only get halfway there, and that sucks to be you. So set the thing like, no, I want to be way more than enough. Like, and you actually are. It's just a question of, do you believe it and do you see it? And visualization is how you do that. So you draw that picture. That's why this thing is called superhuman. Like, look, am I actually superhuman? No, I don't know how to jump over a single building in a bound or whatever the hell Superman does. I don't care, but that's the goal. I want to go there, and I'm totally willing to not get it. So just set that goal and just look at that vision. What would it be like if I just had abundant energy, not just enough?
Dave, thank you. The book will be out October 8th. I think by the time this podcast is out there and everybody's listening, they can get the book, superhuman.com. It's available wherever books are sold.
Actually, not superhuman.com.
Sorry, superhuman.
Probably just go to daveasprey.com.
Just go to daveasprey.com and you can get the book, or go to Amazon.
There you go.
Type it in.
Yeah.
Go to your local bookstore.
Superhuman. It's easy to find.
They're going to find it. Dave, thank you for coming on the Broken Brain Podcast and sharing the story of being superhuman and leaving our listeners with the inspiration to know what's possible and changing that framework around aging.
Drew, thanks for the work you're doing. It matters.
Hi, everyone. I hope you enjoyed the interview. Just a reminder, this podcast is for educational purposes only. This podcast is not, I repeat, it's not a substitute for professional care by a doctor or otherwise qualified medical professional. This podcast is provided on the understanding that it does not constitute medical or other professional advice or services. If you're looking for help in your journey, seek out a qualified medical practitioner. If you're looking for a functional medicine practitioner, you can visit ifm.org and search their Find a Provider database. It's important that you have somebody in your corner that's qualified, that's trained, that's a licensed healthcare practitioner helping you make changes, especially when it comes to your health.